Good morning. As folks are still arriving, I'll go ahead and get us a little bit started because we have a little territory to cover here before we wrap it up. And we've had so much fun, I want to make sure we have some space for conversation. Although I'll, you know, apologize up front because we'll probably try to move this a little bit quicker along today than we have been able to do. And just to make sure we kind of go through the session, the rest of the text. We don't have a lot of text in the book left, but I do want to kind of move a little bit at the end towards some more direct connections that you might make with this text and reflect on it as a whole, and then offer some suggestions for ways to continue thinking about this as well as we turn to other areas. I know a number of folks will be heading out of the village today or tomorrow. And so again, thanks to all of you for your participation this week. And to those of you who have just arrived in the village or are with us for the first time this morning, welcome. It's great to have you with us here. My name is David Vasquez, and I am one of the campus pastors at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And we've been having some great conversation around the book of Ruth. One thing I should have probably mentioned at the beginning for those of you who are new to the Holden community is that all of the sessions that are done as part of the Holden community learning community are recorded, so you can see, you know, big brother over here and two mics. So everybody say hi, Karen.
I mean, hi, Karen.
I'm not sure who's listening to Karen or David, probably. But a lot of the sessions are recorded as a way to provide an opportunity, either if you've missed one of the sessions or want to return to it, they are archived and then posted online, you know, and so that will be happening about August, by the time this session, this summer session, start getting posted. So that you can just access those through the Holden website if you would find it interesting to return to some of the conversations we've been engaging here. Also, a lot of our conversations have been based on a resource that is part of the Book of Faith series that I had the privilege of writing with Diane Jacobson, a professor of Old Testament at Luther Seminary. So, you know, it's a collaboration of Luther College and Luther Seminary. People always confuse the two, so it's great to be able to bring it together. So that resource is through Oxford Fortress, if you're interested, again, in having a similar conversation like this. Some folks had asked about that in your congregations. The scriptures, I think, do provide us an opportunity to provide depth to a conversation, to a number of different conversations in our lives, but certainly to the conversations about mobility in our lives, as well as issues of immigration that we are facing as a nation. So that as an introduction, which, for those of you again who are new, we've spent a week reading our way through the book of Ruth, and that's what you'll need for our conversation this morning as well. You can either read it off the biblical text, we have a couple of Bibles here, there are some outside, we have a couple of copies of this one that's kind of broken down into parts. If anybody need a copy, now we have a couple left here. So so we will do a little bit of kind of catching up very briefly from the week. I'll do a little bit of an introduction a little differently this time, and then we'll kind of get into our conversation back to the text. We're anxious to see what happens at the end of the story here. And so if we can begin with a word of prayer.
Lord Jesus, you come to us as one unknown, without a name, as of old, by the lakeside. You come to those who knew you not. You speak to us the same word, follow me, and set us to take the tasks which you have for us, for our time. Open us up to your surprise, that we may see in you our encounters with others. Amen. Amen.
And that prayer is based on the writings of, Albert Schweitzer. So thank you. Really powerful. And you probably have heard that phrase at the beginning in a hymn, right? You come to us as one unknown, a great hymn in the Cranberry Hymnal, for those that use the worship resource. Sorry for calling it a hymnal. inside joke for pastor, sorry. Okay, anyway, let's see. Well, a lot of what we've been talking about today, this week, has been around the conversation about immigration. We started out the week kind of with a world map, not quite, you know, better than this one, on the chalkboard here for those who will join us. And what we have done is identified the places where each of us were born, where we now live, and then also where our ancestors came from. And that kind of gives us a little bit of the picture of the fact that the conversation of immigration or migration, of mobility, is a part of all of our lives, of our conversations in all of our lives. And so we have been trying to, along other perspectives that we bring to a book as dear to many of us as the Book of Ruth, along with our other perspectives, we also have been bringing up the perspective of immigration, our own experience of mobility, but then also the experiences of those who live every day with awareness of their mobility, particularly those who live as undocumented immigrants in the United States and in other parts of the world. So as we get started right now, what I want to ask you to do is to get very comfortable with each other. Find someone next to you and make a quick list of where things you are wearing were made. Okay, so look at labels, things you have, your shoes, things that are in your purse. So some of those things you can do yourself. Some of you might need somebody near you to help you out. So just quickly, make a quick list of five places to pick for me. All right, so let's come back together briefly here. So let's call out some of the places that, you know, are that we are wearing on our backs.
India.
China. We can just kind of make a big part of China, sorry.
Honduras.
Honduras.
Mexico.
Canada.
Holden.
Yeah.
El Salvador.
El Salvador.
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua.
Dominican Republic.
Dominican Republic. Pardon?
Brazil.
Brazil.
Thailand.
Germany. I think I have my shoes from Thailand.
Vietnam and Jordan.
Jordan, all right.
Oh, my jacket is from Russia.
Alex is
from USA. USA, Alex.
Subicha is from Sweden, right?
Sweden is a really
okay. It's an important one.
Yeah, yeah. And Alex, as we started this, he said, probably China.
Peru.
Peru, okay.
So I'm getting something all American. Braces.
Braces, all right.
Both of them in USA.
If you think back on what's changed in the last 30 years in the way that we shop, or even over your lifetime, basically, this is what we have going on. The world is coming to us, okay? And we can do this anywhere. This is not, it's sometimes still a little surprising by the time we were to make a list, if we were to be exhausted about the list of products that made their way to Holden Village this week from around the world. And if we try to imagine tracing these products back to their origin, and then went even further beyond, not just to the assembly of the product, but the sourcing of materials. I was at a store in Vancouver before we came up here, and while my wife was doing the shopping, I was doing the browsing around, so waiting, right? So I started doing what I often do, is like, so there's this, it was a sports store, and there was one shelf where it had all kinds of running pants, that's all it is, and there were probably 8 different kinds of running pants in the shelf. As I made my way down the shelf, every single style of those pants was made in a different country. You know? And I tried to imagine the sourcing mechanism behind this one little store, you know, to be able to kind of bring, it's one brand that they sell, and they're bringing stuff from all over the world. We have created and developed the most amazing, complex global economic system in human history. You know, you used to be able to go to kind of like Pier 1 and be like, okay, I'm going to go, you know, to a world market. Go down to the grocery store, you know? What's so exciting about that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at breakfast, if you eat fruit for breakfast or whatever, you know, in a yogurt, you'll be eating the world. If we are what we eat, we are global citizens. We are people of the world. Because what we eat, what we consume, what we wear is interconnected. And the reason that this is significant to realize and to keep in mind is because a basic principle about migration is that people follow trade. That's all there is to it. People follow trade. You know? If you want to know and understand migration, like they say, follow the money. Basically, wherever people traded, that's where people go. So why does Joseph end up in Egypt? Because there's a caravan that takes slaves up that way. So when there's hunger, where do his brothers go? To Egypt, because they follow the trade. They know where the food is. They've been sending it there for generations. So when there's need, they do that. It's no surprise that as we have a much more integrated global society and a lot more international trade, we're going to have a lot more international movement of people. So today, we actually have the largest number of people on the moon in the history of humanity. It's hard to imagine the numbers. At the end of World War II, when the High Commissioner for Refugees was established, this was one of the first actions of the United Nations. It was established, the High Commissioner for Refugees was an office that was established to deal with people still displaced after the end of World War II, the largest conflict in human history. They had at that time an estimated 1.1 million people considered refugees. They defined what we now know as a refugee, a fairly narrow definition of what they call a refugee of concern. So it's not just anybody who's displaced, but somebody who meets a very particular definition. 1.1 million at the end of World War II. Today, that same office, the High Commissioner for Refugees, estimates that there are 10.5 million refugees of concern in the world. So refugees alone are tenfold what it was at the end of the largest conflict in human history. So on one end, we have lots of people that are responding to the push of migration. Instability, all kinds of things. And we often think of that when we think of migration in the United States. We think that people are coming here out of desperate situations, that's why they have to come. And that is true. Many people are being forced to move because of conditions in their countries of origin, in their families of origin, persecution for a variety of reasons. However, there's also just a strong motivation to move that is a pull, things that attract people. And part of that is trade. We follow trade. In our conversation at the beginning of the week, we recognize the movement that's been part of our past, perhaps a little bit of what is being part of our present. We also started to think about the fact that it frames our future. You know, for most of us, our children have traveled more than we did, and certainly a lot more than our parents did, you know, in terms of opportunities to move around. My daughter, if many of you have met here at A, has in her life, she will be 7 in August, has been to 5 different countries in her life. You know, and I hadn't. So we've talked about the fact that this matters to us because many biblical stories are about people on the move. And so on the one hand, being aware of our migration stories, our own and that of others, can help us understand these things better. I'm convinced of that, and I think we've kind of had an opportunity to get a sense about that in our conversation this week. But on the other hand, also, the other piece that's significant is that it also means that the stories we read in church Sunday after Sunday, and that maybe part of what we read in the morning or when we go to bed, have much to offer us as we try as a nation to engage a difficult global conversation. This is not an issue only in the United States or a conversation only in the United States. Mobility is happening worldwide. And it's happening both because of that push, and it's happening also because of the pull. How many of you recognize some of these symbols? What are these logos have in common?
Technology.
What else?
Across the world.
They're from all over. They cross the world. They're kind of interconnected. Mm-hmm.
Communication.
Commerce. All right. One other thing they have in common. They were all started by a foreign-born individual. All of them. If you look, I mean, or at least as a partner in the firm that formed, you know, as one of the founders of all of the labels and things that frame our lives, 52% of startups in Silicon Valley are started by foreign-born people. Much of our innovation, much of our future is tied to immigration as well. So while much of our thought and conversation about immigration tends to be consumed by a particular part of the immigration conversation, the reality is that immigration is a much broader spectrum, one on which we depend not only for our strawberries for breakfast, but also for checking our email and staying in touch with people we care about. So the idea of globalization is not just a theory. It is an integral part of our lives. So the concept of sealing our borders, which is often the battle cry for many people, is simply unrealistic and not true. We cannot seal our borders to people while maintaining them open to trade. In fact, we have both gone in both directions. You know, one of the things that's happening is that many of us in this room probably have benefited from this opportunity for travel and for freedom and for movement. How many of you who are here have been on something like YAGM, the Young Adults in Global Mission, and served on that, or served as a missionary abroad for the church, or traveled on a mission trip? So that kind of begins to increase probably some of those experiences in this room. I'm sure that if you think about the moment, the significant moments in many of our congregational lives, for a lot of people it's becoming increasingly important to spend time in partnership with our brothers and sisters in Christianity around the world. This matters to us as well because estimates are that by the year 2050, so talking about 40 years from now, I won't tell you all that, probably 80-something. But by the time my children are my age, one out of five Christians in the world will be non-Hispanic white. Only one out of five. One of the things we noticed at the beginning of our conversation is that our representation here in terms of ancestry and where we live dominated the Northern Hemisphere. Now, this is not what Christianity is expected to look like in 40 years from now. In fact, this is not what the nation is supposed to, it's expected to look like in the generations to come. Just a month ago, an announcement was made by the U.S. Census Bureau that for the first time it is numerically, you know, provable what they expected would happen. That again, over 50% of children born in the United States are not Hispanic white. I mean, under 50%. So that more of the kids being born are non-Hispanic. Fewer of the kids that are being born are non-Hispanic white. So this is something that we can be freaked out about, if that's our inclination, depending on the kind of response we have to the changes around us. Or we can be a people of the gospel. Anytime God encounters a human being, what does God say? Or whoever God's representing, it might be an angel, a burning bush, whatever.
Fear not.
Do not fear. That's the core of the gospel. Do not fear. So that's why this conversation, I think, matters significantly for us. For our present, for our future, for children's lives, for many other things. For issues of justice, all of these things get brought into it. And the people who put together the story of Ruth and shared it with us, you know, a couple thousand years later, knew the importance of that kind of conversation to have depth, to have complexity, to have some humor. You know, they are not portraying this as, well, she's a Moabite. Period. They keep saying she's a Moabite for Moab. But that's not where it ends. The story has much more complexity to it. One of the last things to keep in mind is that we also then are dealing with a spectrum of migration across the board and a need to be connected globally and an opportunity to move globally. So our ability to move has increased. Our trade internationally has increased. At the exact same time, though, the ability of some people to move about, to migrate, is decreasing, particularly the desperately poor. On the exact same year in which the Congress passed NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is the exact same year that they passed increasingly restrictive regulations about the mobility of people. You know, they increased enforcement on immigration and restricted immigration even further. This is nonsensical. It just has never worked. It will never work to try to increase trade and decrease migration. It's just, you know, these are, to some extent, natural forces. Where these two things collide is where things like Postville, that is worse, happen. Where these things have possibility is Postville at its best, the hometown to the world. So which vision is it that we are invited to think about as we continue our conversation around the Book of Ruth? So that's where I wanted to kind of return, and I wanted to provide a little bit more of a broader background of what it at least floats in my mind as I come to this text, especially because right now at the end of the text, in those last few verses of the story of Ruth, we move from that migration to Moab, back to Bethlehem, and then we stand, and we end with that genealogy that tells us what happens next. That's where we, at the end of the week, are starting to think, now what? In a service learning, there's usually a three-phrase kind of thing that's used. What, so what, now what? So we've talked about the what. We've reflected a little bit on the so what. Today, we'll think a little bit about the now what. Okay?
Thank you.
anything that we want to bring with us as we, you know, from the text as we return to it, let's do that kind of briefly here. Any things that people would like to make sure we kind of carry with us into the last section here of the reading?
So the biblical law provided for aliens.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of, if you think about the wisdom of the writers or what God gave the writers, the alien was protected.
Very much. And, you know, the alien is to be treated as one of your own. That's repeated throughout the scriptures. And an interesting thing in the conversation that Paul and I were having yesterday, coming to know about the fact that there's this funky word, hermeneutics. You know, you may be familiar with it, and it basically means what glasses you wear when you're reading a text. Well, the first hermeneutical key, the first set of lenses that the people of God are given in the biblical text comes in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, another funky word, means the second giving of the law. So this is the time when we are recovering the law and going back to it. So when we come to read an existing law, the lenses we are to wear is, number one, remember you were an alien in Egypt. So that's repeated several times throughout Deuteronomy as a central key. Remember your own mobility. This is, whether it's Hebrew's version of it, that we are alien sojourners in this world. You know, this is not our home. It doesn't mean we trash it, because it's not ours. We are committed to it. We care for it. These do not have to be contradictory ideas, but a recognition that this place we live in is not ours. And Native American wisdom, many of us are familiar with, you know, it's not ours, we borrowed it from our children. Whichever version of that we live with, that's a central key. So, yeah, so there are specific laws intended to protect those on the margins, including elements. Other things that we want to carry.
Where Boaz calls Ruth a woman, worthy woman,
yeah.
And where he inherited that, but she earned it, supposedly.
Yeah, but she is told, you are a worthy woman, what you've done now. She has, the alien, the foreigner without status has been named, you know, kind of really high. And that's important to keep in mind as we continue reading as well. Other things that we're going to carry on with us. Well, let's see, and we'll start out on, where was it? All right, we are now at the gates, so I'll set the scene a little bit, but, and we will start reading on verse 9. For chapter 4, verse 9, we just kind of have a few verses here to end the text. So chapter 4, verse 9 of Ruth, and before I do quickly set the scene for where we're at, to remind us of that, if we could have a couple of readers this time, we're going to need Boaz again, so if somebody wants to be Boaz, you need to get, do you have one copy of this?
Yeah. Oh,
here's one right here. So I'll give you that one, thank you. And let's see, we will also need we'll stay with one narrator now, because we don't have a lot left. So one narrator, thank you. And then if you, all of the rest of us who have these, if you can read when it says male elders, all the men who have, you have a couple men that still have some of these with you? Okay, so we can all read the male parts there together. And the same thing for women. If you have the other one, there's a part where it says all, and just says women. I think those are the... So we got our cast ready to go. So basically what's happened so far is we had midnight school where Ruth comes to Boaz out in the threshing floor. They have kind of a very charged encounter. And in the morning, he sends her off with a lot of grain. You know, after she has spent the night and says, you know, take this, make sure you're okay for right now, I will do what you've asked me to do. She's basically proposed to him, and he says, I'll go to it. But there's a little glitch, that there's another guy who has first rights to her. Kind of hard to talk that way in terms of, you know, modern terms, but that's sort of what the law required. So we are left at that point with uncertainty as to whether Boaz is going to do this or not. We talked extensively yesterday about, it's important to recognize the vulnerability that both Ruth and Naomi are in that situation. So the next morning, everything shifts, and the scene changes, and now we're not out in the threshing floor on the outside of the city, where everybody's having a good time, but now we're at the gate of the city. Anybody know why the gate of the city is significant? Or what gates are all about?
Law court.
Huh?
It's the law court.
This is the low car. court. That's exactly the way to think. This is Judge Judy, right? I mean, that's what we're getting to do now, right? We get to hear a little legal terminology here and there thrown around. There's just quite a bit of, you know, a lot is on the line. You know, what's going to happen? As, you know, if we were really to read this without awareness of what happens in the end, when a Boaz first approaches the so-and-so, this friend, the next of kin who, you know, does not, you know, chose his cards early on by, you know, we notice that he's not the best character. But we don't know if he's going to go with it. Initially, he says, sure, I'll take her. And then for at least a moment, we got to go, shoot, now what? And then it all kind of changes. We get the turns and twists. That's where we're at the court, at the gates of the city, where people would come in and out. And so so we'll pick up the story there on 4:9.
No sooner had Boaz gone up to the gate and sat down there than the next of kin, of whom Boaz had spoken, came passing by.
Oh, sorry, actually, I forgot. You said not very well, Mark, for numbers. Sorry.
That is the beginning, but we actually are picking up right here. So, when you do your best,
sorry about that.
He took off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people,
today you are witnesses that I have acquired from the land of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, to be my wife, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance in order that the name of the dead may not be cut off from his kindred and from the gate of his native place. Today you are witnesses.
Then all the people who were at the gate, along with the elders, said,
we are witnesses.
May the Lord make you a woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you produce children in Ephrathah and bestow a name in Bethlehem. And through the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah.
So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife.
I'm going to stop you there for a second, and then we'll pick up right there. We'll come back. So anything that stands out to you right now in this first half of the sections we'll read, what do you notice? What stands out to you?
It's interesting that may your house be like the house of Perez or Tamar bore to Judah. I mean, of all the references that you could make, that particular one was made with the mm-hmm. right.
Can you remind us briefly of why that matters for those who may not have been part of that conversation earlier?
Well, Tamar played the role of prostitute in order to hold her father-in-law to the law, the lever law.
Mm-hmm. So her father-in-law was refusing to let his son be married, the third son, because two of them had died, to marry her, and then she, you know, kind of has to take matters into her own hand.
You can go back into history and pull other names out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. This is interesting. That is what they would change. Yeah, all right. So we talked about this is in the background, and now it becomes obvious. You know, it becomes named in the story. It's almost like if you missed that little note back there, you know, with Ruth coming to the threshing floor, you know, here it is, very obvious. Okay, other.
I wonder if there's ever an opera written on the story. Just look at all the drama. He could have just married her and be done with it. All the drama that goes behind, then she becomes his wife.
Exactly.
Is there an opera written on that?
Exactly. Well, I don't know. Has anybody seen an opera on Ruth? It would be a good one.
But I mean, that is what's striking about the story. It's like a dramatic story, and now you know you have the grand finale, and where it's been often just one or two figures. Now you've got the whole city and the chorus in the background, you know, singing.
You got the Greek chorus, right? Yeah, and certainly for the time frame of the writing, you know, there is certainly these men and women at the end do become a little bit of the chorus, right, in the Greek theater. Some of that influence may be there, you know. You have that early on as well when Naomi first returns. You know, the whole town is stirred. And all the women say, and you can do a very cool song with this, who is this? Is that Naomi? Is that Naomi? In fact, one of the Midrash materials does that with that very question. Is that Naomi? Back then, she used to go around, you know, with a litter of kids and lots of things, and now she's empty-handed. Is that Naomi? And it goes on and on and on with this kind of phrasing is really quite powerful. Other things that you notice in the text here?
I was thinking Elimelech did well financially.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Because he got her inheritance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that now there's a, you know, that is the function of this, is to redeem the land. Someone had asked about, you know, what happens, who actually owns this land after the marriage, and the inheritance actually is done through the males in the legal system. So part of the reason is that the women are being incorporated is because there was no male heir. So the first child of that union, like we said before, will inherit his dead father's inheritance. And part of the reason for this is that there was a huge commitment in the land, in the law, to prevent people from becoming landless. You know, the promise to Abraham was that he would have land. And then eventually that promise becomes fulfilled as the people leave Egypt and return and come to the Holy Land. Lots of things to unwrap in that, but that's sort of the going of the story. And the concern throughout the law is both that through levirate marriage that people will not lose land. You know, land was assigned by tribes, except for Levi that kept the temple, but then all the others distributed the land, and land was to remain within that, including what many of you may be familiar, the levirate laws are in the same chapter as the Jubilee year, which means that every 50 years do you reset, so that if people have lost land over a generation, that the next generation will not be landless, but land is returned to the original owners, you know, to the family owners of those lands, to kind of maintain some stability.
I just think it's interesting that the major newspaper in Israel, Jerusalem Haaretz. I just think that's interesting.
Oh yeah.
Later, that's what they would call their newspaper.
Yeah. Well, and that is, you know, that's when Jesse was with us earlier this week, he had said, you know, in Jewish tradition, the beginning of the book is problematic, is viewed very differently. You know that. It is really almost treason for Elimelech and Ruth to leave the land of Israel. You know, that significantly, of course, know the complexity of that continued conversation in the land of Israel and Palestine today.
There's an acknowledgement of the mother. Mm-hmm. You know, these two women, Rachel and Leah, mm-hmm. together built up the house of Israel. The thing is, yeah, the men are doing this thing, but the mother becomes important in the Jewish culture. Uh-huh. When you trace the lineage.
These are the aunties, right?
So,
but only through their ability to have children, not through.
To a large extent, that's what their source is. Uh-huh. That's the way that it gets framed, you know, that this is what's worth it. But hang on to that comment because we'll get to the end and you'll see what happens in this story. At least that's an interesting tension to that, but I appreciate you mentioning that, because that is true. Oftentimes the definition and the value and the worth of a woman is through their childbearing. Now, in this book, we have Ruth already named worthy without having children, prior to doing so. And that's really significant. So this book is challenging something that is otherwise commonly a part of the culture. So it's not only challenging how we feel about the immigrant, it's also challenging how we deal with women, you know, in the text. Other things about, let's say a little bit about these two women. What do we know about those two other women that are named? We talked about Tamar, but what about Rachel and Leah? Who are they?
Leah was the woman that Jacob married that he didn't want to get married to.
Exactly. Two of them, right? So Rachel and Leah are the sisters, and he married them. There's the two concubines as well. So what are they often called? Anybody know? They're the mothers of Israel. Because Jacob is Israel, right? I mean, Jacob becomes Israel. The mothers of Israel are these women. They are the founding mothers, right? So, who are founding mothers for us? Think about the United States. Who would you consider founding mothers? We know a lot, you probably list a few founding fathers, but...
Martha Washington.
Okay, Martha Washington. Who are some other...
Ellie Madison.
Uh-huh.
Eleanor Roosevelt.
All right.
Susan Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
But whoever fought for suffrage of women's suffrage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Sojourner Truth, all of these women, right? Now, what does it mean that the men in the court of power are naming this foreign woman from an enemy territory as one, comparing her to one of the founding mothers of the nation. If a politician in high power were to compare an undocumented immigrant woman to one of the founding mothers of this nation, what kind of a statement would that be? If they did this not just at home at a party or to their wives, to, you know, make up, but if they did this publicly in the courts of the nation.
They are equal.
I mean, this is powerful.
They did that at the steps of the Capitol, they wouldn't be reelected.
I just get shades of Luke. Is it Luke 4 where Jesus, you know, does his inaugural sermon and then he says, there were widows in places other than where Elijah went, and there were, I mean, he lists all these other places that God has redeemed, and it gets him almost pushed off the cliff.
Exactly.
God has mercy for people outside of Israel, heaven is known.
These are charged words. Anything else that stands out to you here in what we have read thus far? All right. There's probably more that we can unpack, but let's continue moving a little bit here. So who would like, actually one note before we read the next section. Say, I got in terms of the context for Leah and Rachel, two things for context scripturally. One is that when you look at the stories of Genesis, you know, oftentimes we kind of think not a lot of stories of women are not preserved a lot in the biblical text. But if you look at Genesis alone, especially the kind of the particular stories, after the universal story and then you move to the particular, chapters 12 through 39, so it's kind of like a chunk in there, half the stories in there are about women. So that at the beginning, the founding mothers are, you know, their names are known, their stories are told. That happens significantly. So in spite of all of the cultural biases, these stories continue to remain, including the one we're reading now, within the text. You know, so oftentimes many scholars have asked, how many have we missed? You know, that did get the axe because they were too troubling. But they certainly were a part of the witness of faithful people trying to understand the relationship with God and with one another. And so that's a significant piece to keep in mind that, Ruth's story is being tied to that. We spoke earlier that her character is being tied to Abraham. And there's all these different things that are being done in the text, and now she's being directly tied also to the women who have shaped the people of Israel. And the second thing is that then she also shows up in that genealogy at the end, or rather in the genealogy of Jesus himself, which we'll get back to towards the end of our meeting. Let's go ahead and read on, so we'll pick up where we had left off. I think it was in verse, kind of starting in verse 13 again.
So Boaz took
Ruth. Yep.
So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi,
Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nurturer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him.
Then Naomi took the child and laid him into her bosom and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying,
A son has been born to Naomi.
They named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the descendants of Perez. Perez became the father of Ram of Abinadab, and maybe you can carry from there.
So Aminadab of Nashon, okay. Nashon of Salmon of Boaz of Obed of Jesse, and Jesse of David. And David being, of course, the one that would become King David. Anything that stands out to you?
Is Perez? Does he come from somewhere?
Yeah, Perez is the son of Tamar. So Perez is the one who was born of that woman, you know, of this kind of relationship where Tamar had to kind of demand her rights with her father-in-law. And so she's born of the relation of that relationship.
Well, they're all singing to Naomi and not to Ruth.
Mm. So there's an interesting shift happening here about who's the local, who's not. Not everything's resolved. All right.
I was curious about, there must be some symbolism with Naomi becoming, when she, it said to me, it'd be nursemaid, that she must have nursed him.
Yeah.
So obviously the obvious question is she's older, and how could, you know, I know they had nursemaids, but they're usually younger women. So, you know, I'm saying, well, don't ask that question. Mm-hmm. But what would be the symbolism?
You know, I've read a few different articles on this, and they kind of go in every imaginable direction. So I think it's a little bit. There's certainly a tradition of nursemaids. It was common in the culture. Often children were raised by all the mothers rather than individually. You know, kind of like what eventually happened even in the kibbutz in the early stages of Israel. Where children were raised kind of communally. So there's within the family, not necessarily the entire village, but the family. And what it means for somebody to be the nursemaid of somebody, it's a little confusing. So for example, when you see Sarah, who is said to be the nurse, you know, to be nursing Ishmael, so before she has a child, the reality is that when it comes time to for the baby to be born to the concubine, you know, she is placed between Sarah, I've got to keep the name straight here, between Naomi's thighs to give birth. So that, I mean, sorry, not Naomi, but Sarah. So this is considered then Sarah's son until she decides that, you know, or they decide that they want to find a different child, of, you know, born biologically from her. So it's a little confusing, but certainly what it seems to be happening here is a little bit of confusion about, you know, who is to be celebrated? What is the relationship like? We talked about the significance of the relationship between Naomi and Ruth, and the closeness of that relationship. And now, who's being celebrated? Let's notice, though, that even though the song is about Naomi, and she's the one who's given the son, what is Ruth named by the women? It was very powerful to hear all of you saying it together. What is Ruth named? What do they say about her?
Your daughter.
Your daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. What else do they say about it?
More to you than seven sons.
Okay, now, anything about that statement strikes you?
Well, seven's a very significant number.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I think it stands for completeness.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so it's basically through this foreign woman, Naomi's life has been completed.
This woman has been completed. The one who was empty, I went away full, I came back empty, is now, at the end of the book, complete. So that's significant. But what else? Think about,
Well,
yeah, they're saying about Ruth, she's better to you than seven sons. How would that fly?
Some are
even
the best.
Yeah.
Like what they want.
Not only one, but seven. She's better to you than seven sons. So there's some ambivalence still happening. We're trying to figure out to play by the rules. I mean, I'm troubled by the fact, I mentioned it yesterday, that the women who have been the primary actors in the story disappear. Neither of them say a word in chapter 4. After Naomi says, wait and see, they're both silent. We hear nothing again from them. So it's really difficult because not everything has been resolved. And yet there's this amazing statements within the story, even at its end, you know, celebrating this immigrant woman as one of the mothers on the ancestry, and then as better than seven sons. So that what's interesting is, going back to the comment you had made earlier about the worth of women being through their childbearing, is that that is often a common thing. You know, when you think about many of the women who lament having no children or are excluded because of it. The statement that is significant here is that if you read it closely, it is what's worth here, the redemption, you know, the one who's redeeming her, is not that Ruth is worthy because of the son, but the son is worthy because of the relationship between Ruth and Naomi. mean, this is radical shift that is easy to miss. So look at what it says. And through the children of the Lord, oh no, sorry, that's a man. So the woman said, verse 15, he shall be to you a restorer of life. That's that Goel that we've been talking about, the Redeemer. Okay, and the word Goel shows up, I'm trying to remember, I think it's somewhere close to 14 times in chapter 4. You know, we don't see it in English because it's translated as different words, both of the noun and the verb. But Goel, so he has become to you the Goel, the restorer, the redeemer of life, and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law loves you. She's more to you than seven sons. So the child's redemption, his ability to redeem Naomi, to be the hero of the story, is because of his mother's relationship. You know, because of her mother. So here and then here.
So is Ruth kind of like a surrogate in a sense? And is it always the firstborn that is like Naomi's? When do children become her own?
Yeah, you know, I'm not totally clear because especially in the time frame of the book, it's difficult to place exactly. So, you know, certainly some people have said it's similar to what happens in Chinese culture still today, that the children are raised by the grandparents. You know, if you read Tiger Mother or whatever, you know, that basically it emphasizes the fact that, you know, grandma had it right. So grandma will always be better at raising children than mom will. So within certain cultures, including a lot of Chinese culture, the children are actually a generation late. So, I mean, you bear them, but your mother is the one who raises them. And then you will raise your daughter's children. I mean, so I'm not sure, you know, that I can specifically, I don't know, others here might have better understanding of what, you know, if there is a particular point in which that happens. Certainly the women are significantly involved, and with so much movement, often the grandparents are not in the picture. But in this case, that, you know, maybe part of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Just a comment about Ruth and Naomi, the principal people disappearing. I guess in a way it's not surprising to me because of the context. If you think of it again as story, it strikes me like, for example, film. If you're going to tell a successful story that gets a wide audience, mm-hmm. About immigration, you've got to have somebody white in the story, to have the movie successful. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, whose story is it? And if the story is Israel's story, where a wonderful point is made about this foreigner, mm-hmm. if the story from beginning to end was all Ruth's voice, mm-hmm. it wouldn't be read.
So in some ways, the story challenges the power structure, but it doesn't necessarily revert it yet.
It doesn't support,
you know,
it, yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Not yet. Yeah. But that's part of what it's trying to undermine. And you're right. I mean, in some ways, that may be the concern about Naomi that we've phrased as well. You know, what's happening here? Well, there's self-interest in this. Basically, it's saying this is not just for the well-being of Ruth, but there's self-interest in caring for Ruth. The future depends on this relationship and in caring for the other and the foreigner. Our own future, not just hers. Did you?
It seems to me also that this is a reassurance to Naomi, because when she came back, she said to the women, "The Lord has dealt harshly with me, and I am bitter." And she had nothing. The women are reminding her, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin." Mm-hmm. And not only that, mm-hmm. he has blessed you more than seven sons ever could.
Some power in these words for somebody who is in desperate need of good news.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the people bringing the good news are also people who have the power. Because mm-hmm. it's the women that are saying, it's not the men, it's not the girls, the city gates, but it's the women saying this, and that's what we're left with.
Yeah. Yeah. We're left with the song of the women, the choir of the women. The men have had their say, and they have accepted her, incorporated her. Remember, the entire thing has been driven by these two women who began, you know, a secret marriage ceremony before anybody knew. You know, they have kind of all along found ways to work around power to create a different ending for the story.
A powerful verse for me yesterday was in chapter 3, verse 18, again, if my eyes are working, she replied, this is Naomi, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. And then now you say today the characters fade away. Well, to me, yesterday that was also God's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Wait.
Wait for
all
the Lord.
All the times we've been asked to wait, mm-hmm. be still.
Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily waiting on the man.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were literally in the story, but then if you pull up and universally to me, it gave me powerful hope. When you said, whose story is this? It's really God's story.
Mm-hmm.
When you ultimately, so to me that verse was really powerful because that's what reminds me to stop and wait through all the different maybe challenges in my life or hurts or whatever. Is wait.
Mm-hmm.
Wait upon the Lord. Be still.
Mm-hmm.
He's not done.
Yeah.
So to me it carries a thread of he's not done with any of this. And then the ending, like, see, he's not done. Jesse, David, it's going to keep continuing
yeah.
that powerful thread. So even though that seemed at first like a minor little verse.
Mm-hmm. All of a sudden it gains its significance.
It really jumped at me yesterday. Now with this conversation, for me it's that big, strong thread going through.
Exactly. And the balance between action and waiting, right? We are called to both. Mm-hmm. There are moments for action, and there are moments for waiting. And it's hard to tell which is which. You know, we have all of the very articulate language from Martin Luther King about the struggle of being told to wait. You know, so who decides when the waiting happens, you know?
How do we ever get out of God's way when every day I say, let me follow your way today, Lord?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes, and then I walk right out and take charge.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, so that this is a place where the book is playing with both of those things, the waiting and the action. So I wanted to, there's a couple of things I was thinking we would kind of contextualize this a little bit as we wrap up, you know, we have about 10 minutes here. I want to show you a brief video that will take a little bit of our time here, but I think it will be significant. What's happening at the end of the story is that, again, we're being focused into the future. You know, the child is now born, it becomes a redeemer through the relationship of the two women, and there's lots of things that have been raised for us. So, let's watch this video for you.
My name is Jose Antonio Vargas. I was born in the Philippines. I moved to the United States when I was 12. My mother wanted to give me a better life, so she sent me to live with my grandparents in Silicon Valley. I loved America the moment I got here. Embraced the language, the culture, the people. English was my second language, and I learned to speak American by watching Frasier, Home Improvement, the Goldbergs. I won the spelling bee in eighth grade by spelling indefatigable. In high school, I fell in love with journalism. I started working for my local newspaper, The Miami Voice. Then I got hired at The Washington Post. I covered the 2008 presidential campaign, from traveling on Hillary Clinton's plane to pheasant hunting with Huckabee. I covered Al Gore for Rolling Stone and profiled Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker. I even won a Pulitzer Prize for covering the Virginia Tech massacre. At age 16, I rode my bike to the DMV to get my driver's permit. I brought my green card with me. The woman at the DMV flipped it around. She leaned over and she whispered, "This is fake. Don't come back here again." I went home and confronted my grandfather. That was the first time I realized that I'm an undocumented immigrant. What some people call an illegal. The first person I told was Mrs. Denny, my choir teacher, after she told me that she was planning a choir trip to Japan. I told her I couldn't afford it. But she said, "We'd find a way. We figure it out." Then I decided to tell her the truth. "It's not really about the money," I said. "I don't have the right passport. I'm not supposed to be here." Mrs. Denny got it. The next day, she told me the choir was going to Hawaii instead.
just mattered to me that Jose was hardworking, he was enthusiastic, he was always coming to class, and it's our job to educate them, to make them better citizens of the world. It doesn't matter what country they're from or, you know, what their background or their legal papers are.
Mrs. Nettie was the very first member of my personal Underground Railroad, Americans who decided to help undocumented immigrants like me. Other members of my Underground Railroad include Rich Fisher, my high school superintendent, and Pat Hyland, my high school principal. For more than a decade now, Pat and Rich have been with me every step of the way, guiding me and supporting me as I try to define what it means to be an American. I define American as someone who works really hard, someone who's proud to be in this country and wants to contribute to it. I'm independent. I pay taxes. I'm self-sufficient. I'm an American. I just don't have the right papers. I take full responsibility for my actions, and I'm sorry for the loss that I broke. What would you do if you were a choir teacher and found out that a student in your glee club can't travel for a competition? What would you do if you were a high school principal and found out that one of your students can't apply for financial aid? What would you do if your child's best friend didn't have papers? As a journalist, I've decided to do what I know best, ask questions. So let's talk. What would you do?
The story portrays Boaz as somebody who has papers and who chooses to side with somebody who doesn't without having to, somebody who could take advantage. In the story of Exodus, we were reminded the other day that Pharaoh's daughter stands up to her dad and makes a choice. Jose refers to those who supported him as his personal underground railroad and invites us to talk about this differently. What connections do you see between these two stories? We only have a couple of minutes. What are some things that linger for you as we wrap up this, and I know this is more open than it is wrapped up, but a couple of comments.
The importance of personal story to subvert power. Confront power. Personal story.
I think I shared with you yesterday that my great-grandfather was an illegal immigrant because he came from Norway to the United or to North America and walked from Canada to Iowa. You know, nobody stopped him. He didn't have any doctor papers or anything like that. He just farmed and, you know, started a family and raised a family, and it just grew exponentially, and they were Americans. So I'm the offspring of an illegal immigrant.
I'm wondering if Ruth ever felt like she was not really part of the society that she's living in. If she was more.
We talked a lot about that, you know, earlier in the week, to say how long does it take before you feel a part of the society. To what extent do looks continue to isolate them? You know, talking to one of our current students, I think, you know, she's gone back to the kitchen, but Colleen was talking about a roommate who is second generation born here, but who still is perceived as being from somewhere else, always asked where she's from, in a different way than just trying to find out what part of St. Paul.
One thing that occurs to me, and I've heard this story, I haven't seen this video, but when you listen to that, it's like if you let your heart respond to that story, how could you see him for anything other than just a true, you know, member of the society? I mean, it just strikes me as incredible that he could not be seen that way. That compassion in the heart this is about.
And this is a legal question, right? And that's why we are in the court. And it's a legal question because in the court, this foreigner that was defined that way at the beginning and throughout the book is called Ma the Moai, is named one of the founding mothers. And that's charged language. To claim to be an American, when that's not legally true, it's a legal matter. President Obama has recently announced what is called the First Action for Dreamers. There are resources out there, and I do encourage you to explore that as one of the So What venues or Now What venues. I think as a church we have the opportunity with this action to identify children whose stories are very much like Jose's. It's a complicated matter. I'll say it briefly, but we're out of time, unfortunately. But I'll give you 1 minute if you don't mind with your time. Immigration enforcement is something that the executive branch does. The law is done by the legislative branch, and the legislative branch has been tied in knots for over 20 years around immigration and has made no changes to the law, even though the world has changed in 25 years since the last revision. So the executive branch is responsible for executing the law. They can't physically deport 10 to 12 million people out of the country. It's physically impossible to do. Even though they're doing it to the tune of about 500,000 a year, they still cannot deport everybody out of the country. It's just not physically possible. So they make choices about where they emphasize deportation. So all that Obama has said is simply that he's made a decision to instruct immigration not to deport a particular group of people. And it's a very narrow group that meets certain categories. Arrived in the United States under the age of 16, has been in the U.S. for 5 years as a minimum, continuously, and in the country on the June 15, enrolled in high school, or has a GED, or discharged veteran, a U.S. Coast Guard or armed forces. Not been convicted of a felony, a couple of other concerns, and at least 15 years old, and then are not above the age of 30. So you are likely to know many people who fit that category. The order's been given, it will take 60 days from the way that the order was given in June 15. So 2 months from that, about 45 days from now, immigration enforcement has to say how they will do this. Now what this means is that people will give a reprieve only themselves. They can't support their families, this doesn't affect anybody else. But if they're the ages between 15 and 30, they can get a temporary status. It basically means they will not be deported if they meet this category, and they will also be able to apply for a work permit.
But they're not going to be citizens
automatically? Not at all. This is not even a path to citizenship. This makes no change in their status because, again, the president cannot, the executive branch, immigration cannot change people's status. That's a legislative matter. So this is by no means the Dream Act in the way that people have thought of it, but it pushes the conversation. I was interviewed after this announcement was made, you know, from some newspaper in Iowa who wanted to know what I thought. And mostly they wanted to know if I thought it was political. And I said, yeah, it's a president. Don't we elect presidents to make political decisions? But I said, it is political, even if it's trying to take advantage, whatever you want to call it, in an election year. What I see is that it forces the conversation to be had as part of the election process. And it forces some discussion about that, which I welcome for us to have. So, your hands up, and I want to kind of just announce where, you know, we are at our time, so if you need to leave, please feel free to do that. But if you would like to continue this conversation, and I'm sorry to kind of throw this at the end, we ran a little out of time shorter than I wanted to. But thank you again for a great week and participation.